It's 6 hours, Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
White House says U.S. limited in defending Kobani against Islamic State, and first U.S. Ebola patient dies in a Dallas hospital. I'm Bill Michaels reporting from Washington. The White House says the U.S. military is limited in what it can do to try to stop the Syrian border city of Kobani from falling to Islamic State. Spokesman Josh Earnest said Wednesday it's not the same kind of ground operation in Syria that was in place in Iraq, where U.S. airstrikes helped Iraqi and Kurdish forces push back the militants. Earnest said this limits the effectiveness of U.S. airstrikes on Islamic State targets in Syria.
And you have seen the U.S. military carry out airstrikes in this region that have degraded the ability of ISIL to carry out this function. Now, is this going to stop ISIL from overrunning Kobani? I don't think anybody knows. That's why we're concerned about this situation. It's why that another core component of our strategy is training and equipping Syrian opposition fighters so that they can take the fight to ISIL on the ground in their own country.
Kurdish fighters are battling Islamic State for control of Kobani. The first Ebola patient diagnosed in the United States died Wednesday in Dallas. Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital says Thomas Eric Duncan died 10 days after he entered the facility. He came to Dallas on September 20th from his native Liberia, the epicenter of the West African Ebola outbreak. The chief of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, Dr. Thomas Frieden, says he is deeply saddened by Duncan's death, calling him the face people now will associate with the Ebola virus. This is VOA News. Lawyers for Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta have asked the International Criminal Court to drop charges of crimes against humanity against him. ICC prosecutors have said they do not have enough evidence to try Mr. Kenyatta, who's accused of helping to organize 2008 post-election violence that left more than 1,100 people dead. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond have reaffirmed their support for Ukraine's sovereignty. The two diplomats met Wednesday in Washington and during a joint news conference said Russia must withdraw its forces immediately from eastern Ukraine and stop material support for separatists in the region. Kerry and Hammond said Russia must respect a September 5th ceasefire agreement between Ukraine's government and the rebel leaders. Secretary Kerry.
Russia's actions over the past months have challenged the most basic principles of our international system. Borders cannot and should not be redrawn at the barrel of a gun. And people have a right in their own country, within their sovereign borders, to determine their own future.
Foreign Secretary Hammond.
Ukraine is a sovereign country. Its people are entitled to make their decisions about their country's future. There can be no Russian veto on Ukrainian democracy.
According to the United Nations, there have been 331 deaths recorded in eastern Ukraine since the ceasefire agreement was signed. Afghan authorities have executed 5 men convicted of gang rape, despite allegations of flawed legal proceedings. Former President Hamid Karzai signed the execution order last month on his last day in office. In August, 8 men, some dressed in police uniforms, stopped a family's car outside Kabul and sexually assaulted 4 women, including one who was pregnant. A public outcry followed with street demonstrations in support of the victims. Given the quick trial and executions, human rights groups questioned whether due process standards were met. They had asked new President Ashraf Ghani to stay the executions so the proceedings could be reviewed. The deportation trial for one of 3 Afghan soldiers who fled a training exercise in the United States to seek asylum has been scheduled for December 9th. An immigration judge in New York State Wednesday said bond at $25,000 for Major John Urash, but his lawyer said the major will not immediately be released because the amount is extraordinarily high for a non-criminal immigration case. From Washington, I'm Bill Michaels, and this is VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 9th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberians mourn the death of the first U.S. Ebola patient, Thomas Eric Duncan.
The community is saddened that it happened so quickly. They are in disbelief and total shock. The pulse and the prayers and prayers reaches to the Duncan family, his fiancée, his son, his mother, and the rest of his family.
Stanley Gay is president of the Liberian Community Association of Dallas-Fort Worth. The U.S. calls for a stepped-up global response to Ebola. Mali's foreign minister calls for the creation of a rapid reaction force to deal with terrorism in his country. And Kenyans react to President Uhuru Kenyatta's appearance at the ICC.
So I think the real reason why they were being tried was to prevent them from leadership. It was very, very political. There was somebody who never wanted the two to become leaders in this country.
That's Nairobi resident James Unjuguna. We will also speak to a Kenyan member of parliament who is one of 12 Kenyan lawmakers in The Hague to show their support for President Kenyatta. And Zimbabwe's first lady vows to fight factionalism within the ruling ZANU-PF party. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberians in Dallas, Texas, and at home are mourning the death of Thomas Eric Duncan, the first Ebola patient diagnosed in the United States. Duncan died yesterday at the Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital, where he was being hospitalized since September 20th after arriving from Liberia. As a consequence, the United States Wednesday announced enhanced screening for travelers from Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Stanley Gay, president of the Liberian Community Association of Dallas-Fort Worth, says Liberians are shocked by Duncan's sudden death because they had hoped that he would get better treatment in the United States.
The community is saddened that it happened so quickly. They are in disbelief and total shock. The pulse and the prayers and prayers reaches to the Duncan family, his fiancée, his son, his mother, and the rest of his family.
So you said that the community is saddened that it happened so quickly. What do you mean by that?
That it happened. They didn't expect this to happen. They didn't expect him to pass. We were all hoping that he come to his sense. He was at a hospital in the United States where we feel that he was going to have proper care.
Is there a feeling among some people there in the community that Mr. Duncan did not get enough treatment that you were hoping he would get?
Yeah, like the settlement in the community, most of the people that I've gotten calls from leadership in the various Liberian community within the United States and within our community, that's what they are believing in. And that's what they are saying, that they don't think he was treated properly or even given the right medication to save his life.
Now, I'm speaking to you from where? You are at the church, or what's happening there?
Right now, you are speaking to me. I'm at Louise Cho, the fiancé of Mr. Duncan Church, where she worship, Wilshaw Baptist Church. They are having a virtual service for him and the family. We were invited by the pastor of the church. So we are here to support the church, support Mr. Duncan and his family, and to show solidarity.
Louise, the fiance of Mr. Duncan, how is she?
I spoke to her this morning. Her spirit was weak. She couldn't believe it. She had hope that Mr. Duncan would have come true. And she also feels the same way, that he was not treated fairly. He didn't get proper care. And I asked her if she sees herself doing well, and her nephew and the folks and the other kids that are with her, they are not showing any symptoms as of today. And she asked that we continue praying for her and the rest of the people that have been in contact with Mr. Duncan, and also for our country, Liberia, and the other West African country that's facing this virus.
I did see, I think it was on CNN or one of the television networks, where food was delivered to where the fiancé is staying. What has the community done to support her?
What the community have done, she contacted me personally on Sunday. She gave us a list of items that she needed. She had been fed by the Red Cross, but she said she needed some African food. So me and my vice president and other community leaders went out and did some shopping for her. Bought all what she requested, potato greens, palm butter, cassava leaf, meat, chicken, what have you. We bought almost 2 or 3 weeks of food for her. We also have opened an account for the family at Wells Fargo. And anyone that wants to donate can go to the Liberian Community Association website, and they should have all the information listed on it.
Stanley Gay is president of the Liberian Community Association of Dallas-Fort Worth. He was speaking with me from Dallas, Texas. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has issued an urgent plea for countries to step up their response to the Ebola outbreak. He made his appeal in Washington on Wednesday as hospital officials in Texas announced that a Liberian man who was diagnosed with Ebola has died. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Duncan has the story.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says there is an urgent need for more countries to move resources to help fight Ebola. He outlined some of the needs during a joint appearance in Washington with British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond.
We need Ebola treatment units. We need healthcare workers. We need medevac capacity. We need mobile laboratory and staff. We need non-medical support.
He said the United States and Britain together have provided about $120 million to the United Nations effort to fight Ebola. But he said, as a whole, global contributions have fallen short of needs.
We need people to step up now. Now is the time for action, not words. And frankly, there is not a moment to waste in this effort.
Hammond said the global community has to get ahead of Ebola.
But if we get ahead of it, if we rise to the challenge, we can contain it and beat it.
As the two leaders discussed Ebola and other issues in Washington, Texas health officials announced that Ebola patient Thomas Eric Duncan had died. Duncan was diagnosed with Ebola after he flew from Liberia to the United States. In another development, the U.S. government announced plans to launch additional layers of screening to help stop the spread of Ebola. White House spokesman Josh Earnest says the government will begin taking the temperatures of travelers from Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea as they arrive at five key U.S. airports.
We're able to target these measures specifically to individuals who are traveling from these three countries.
He said the new screening measures will begin within the next few days. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, the State Department.
Mali's foreign minister warned Wednesday his country is at risk of becoming a destination for hordes of terrorists as attacks by armed groups have increased. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir reports that Minister Abdoulaye Diop urged the UN Security Council to create a rapid reaction force to deal with terrorists in his country.
Foreign Minister Abdoulaye Diop called for all armed groups to renounce terrorism and accept the extended hand of the government. He urged the UN Security Council to review and strengthen the mandate of its nearly 10,000-member peacekeeping force so that it could better protect civilians. He spoke from Bamako via a video link and is heard here through an interpreter.
Perhaps the council should consider setting up a rapid intervention force which is capable of effectively fighting terrorists.
He warned that drug traffickers and jihadists have returned to northern Mali, and he expressed concern about increased attacks on UN peacekeepers. 10 UN troops have been killed in two attacks in the north since Friday, and 21 others since the mission was deployed in July 2013. Dozens more peacekeepers have been wounded. UN peacekeeping chief Hervé Ladsous also briefed the council from Bamako, where he traveled to attend a memorial service for the slain peacekeepers. He said a combination of factors has led to the increase in attacks on UN troops, including the drawdown of French forces in the north and a perceived lack of Malian security forces. He said MINUSMA, as the UN mission is known, is the main international presence in the north, making it a target.
And of course, this makes us the target for all these spoilers, extremists, jihadists, traffickers, who would want to have the ground exclusively to themselves so as to be able to carry on with their nefarious activities.
Ladsous warned the United Nations is no longer working in a peacekeeping environment. He said the organization is working on measures to increase protection of the mission's staff, equipment, and bases. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 9th, and please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta has become the first sitting head of state to appear before the International Criminal Court at The Hague. Back home, Kenyan public opinion is divided about whether or not he should be there and how justice should be served. Hillary Hewler has more for VOA from Nairobi.
Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta is facing charges of crimes against humanity for allegedly helping orchestrate the post-election violence that left more than 1,000 Kenyans dead and hundreds of thousands displaced. Although his ICC appearance Wednesday was at a status conference, Kenyans back home have mixed feelings about whether their president should be there at all. George Omundi thinks it's important Mr. Kenyatta obey the summons of an international institution like the ICC. If he had refused to attend, he would have appeared uncooperative, Omundi says. Now that he's standing before the court, it's clear he's willing to cooperate. Tracy Karanja agrees, although she thinks Mr. Kenyatta is innocent.
He's showing he has respect for law, and at least he's showing he's open to justice, and he's showing he's not afraid.
Last year, the African Union resolved that sitting African heads of state should be immune from prosecution by the ICC, and such cases should be handled domestically. But many Kenyans say that in cases involving their leaders, they cannot trust the courts at home. Walter Karanja explains that it can be difficult in Kenya to hold rich people accountable.
This is our leaders, and I think they have a lot of money, and I know they can do everything. But when they go to ICC, I think there will be justice there, because there is no corruption there. Because most of our court here, I think there is corruption.
But not everyone in Kenya is happy to see their president stand trial. Mr. Kenyatta handed power temporarily to his deputy, William Ruto, in order to be tried as an individual. But some Kenyans are concerned about what could happen in his absence. Dennis Kyalo is one of them.
Let's, for example, something like terrorism attacks happened today, the attack. So with the commander-in-chief, because he handed powers, but we don't know the level of powers he handed to the deputy vice president, who is William Ruto. So that's the main concern I'm having right now as a Kenyan. If anything happens today, who will be the commander-in-chief for these forces?
And then there are many Kenyans who don't think Mr. Kenyatta should be on trial in the first place. James Juwuna says he thinks the president has been unfairly singled out for prosecution. If there is to be a trial, he says, there are other political leaders who should be in the dock instead.
So I think the real reason why they were being tried was to prevent them from leadership. It was very, very political. There was somebody who never wanted the two to become leaders in this country.
As it stands now, he says, there's no evidence against Mr. Kenyatta. Hillary Hewler for VOA News, Nairobi.
A Kenyan lawmaker said President Uhuru Kenyatta's appearance at the International Criminal Court to face a variety of charges, including crimes against humanity, demonstrates respect for Kenya's constitution and the country's international obligation as a signatory to the Rome Statute that established the ICC. John Muriti Waiganyo is a leading member of Kenya's Parliamentary Committee on Justice and Legal Affairs. He tells reporter Peter Clarty that he is one of about 12 Kenyan lawmakers who are in The Hague to show their support for President Kenyatta.
It's a demonstration that our president respects the constitution of Kenya, respects the International Treaty and Convention, and has committed to cooperate with the International Criminal Court because he believes he's innocent. He pleaded not guilty. He has been consistent in his cooperation with the court, and he does not see any problem in appearing in that court in his capacity as Mr. Uhuru Kenyatta, not necessarily his excellence to the President of the Republic of Kenya. He's magnanimous like that.
How do you respond to people who say that his presence there is an embarrassment to Kenya, especially when now the headlines across the world is that Kenya's president happens to be the first president that has a case to answer, including charge human rights violations, among others?
I would say, to the contrary, President Kenyatta has demonstrated to the world that being a president of an independent republic does not necessarily mean that you cannot yourself, in your personal capacity, handle your own personal challenges effectively, efficiently, and that you, as Mr. Uhuru Kenyatta, can appear in a criminal court under criminal jurisprudence and defend your name. So those who are saying he's an embarrassment to the country are wrong. And what I would want to say is that Kenya now has taken its place in the world map as a country that is led by a man who respects the rule of law.
Over 100 of you parliamentarians are there to morally support him. Why the need, even if you are paying from your own pocket?
I want to tell you this. Even in our local court, if you go in any local court, you will find that the galleries of our court are full with friends, relatives, litigants, witnesses. So there's nothing unusual about this. I am at The Hague myself as a honorable member of parliament. But I'm not here as representing of general constituency. I have made my own arrangement for my constituency to land on. I'm here for only 3 days. I come to The Hague as a friend of Mr. Uhuru Kenyatta, as a friend. First of all, as a friend, but not as a member of parliament. So really, there's nothing wrong.
John Muriti Waiganyo is a leading member of Kenya's Parliamentary Committee on Justice and Legal Affairs. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from The Hague. Zimbabwe's First Lady, Grace Mugabe, on Wednesday vowed to fight factionalism that is steering the ruling ZANU-PF party as factions jostle for vantage positions in the race to succeed the aging President Robert Mugabe. The First Lady this week claimed that some senior party members are working with the opposition and the West to remove her husband from office. But on Wednesday, she was more conciliatory, vowing to fight divisions to save the Liberation Party. Grace Mugabe is on a campaign trail en route to taking over the leadership of the ruling party's Women's League at the elective Congress in December. Thomas Chiripasi has details from Harare.
Thousands of ZANU-PF supporters gathered at the City Sports Center in Harare for the First Lady's Meet the People tour of all provinces ahead of ZANU-PF's elective Congress set for December. Grace Mugabe was recently nominated by the party's Women's League to become the wing's secretary, a key position that allows her to sit in the Politburo, ZANU-PF's supreme decision-making body between Congresses. As she enters the political fray at a time when the ruling party is sharply divided over President Robert Mugabe's failure to deal with the succession question, the First Lady wasted no time on the podium, urging unity among the party's warring factions. She proceeded to call to the stage the party's chairperson for Harare province, Amos Midzi, and a leader of the Youth League in the province, Godfrey Gomwe, and pleaded with them in public to resolve their differences that resulted in violence in Mbare recently.
Today, we are going to change the face of ZANU-PF. Yes, we have wronged each other, but we should have the spirit to forgive each other and unite.
Mrs. Mugabe said factionalism in the party was being spearheaded by some senior officials, adding that she received reports that there were some of the unnamed officials who had mobilized people to demonstrate against her today. She told the gathering that some of the placards were confiscated by law enforcement agents who provided security at the rally. ZANU-PF is reportedly split into two factions, battling to succeed President Mugabe. One camp is reportedly led by Vice President Joyce Mujuru, while the other one is linked to Justice Minister Emmerson Mnangagwa. However, the two leaders have denied leading any factions and have pledged their loyalty to Mr. Mugabe. Reporting from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
It's coming up at 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Owuma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak After Sports News, we begin with athletics. Athletics Kenya is in a race against time to secure the necessary government financial guarantees to save their bid to stage the 2017 IWF World Youth Athletics Championships. The Athletics Kenya head, Isaiah Kiplagat, revealed in Nairobi on Wednesday. Kenya submitted their bid to stage the event within the deadline of the 25th of September. The World Athletics governing body, IWF, has given Kenya until the end of October to submit documents confirming the Kenya government's financial backing. Kenya is vying with the United States of America and Canada to stage the event. Meanwhile, the cities of Barcelona in Spain, Doha in Qatar, and Eugene in the United States of America are official candidate cities to host the 2019 IWF World Athletics Championships, the International Association of Athletics Federations revealed in Monaco. The World Athletics governing body says an evaluation commission will visit each city between the 14th and 31st of October. The IWF will name the successful bid in Monaco on the 18th of November. In Taekwondo, hosts Rwanda dominated the Taekwondo Ambassadors Cup they hosted in Kigali. The event featured senior men and women's teams, as well as boys and girls under 14 and under 17 age groups. Burundi were runners-up ahead of Kenya, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Uganda. In disability sports, Algeria will host the 2015 Goalball Africa Championships, the International Blind Sports Federation disclosed in Bonn, Germany. The event will feature a men's and women's competition from the 20th to the 30th of November next year, and it is a qualifier for the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Paralympic Games in Brazil. Finally, in football, the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations hosts Morocco will host the Central African Republic in a friendly match in Marrakech today, Thursday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Thursday morning, October 9th.
I wish to express my heartfelt condolence to the government and people of America on the loss of her citizens to Ebola virus. And I urge the U.S. not to relent in combating the disease in Africa. I am Prince John Ushir, Obanuku in Obodu Cattle Ranch, Crossover State, Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to DaybreakAfrica@voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The first Ebola patient diagnosed in the United States died Wednesday in Dallas. Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital says Thomas Eric Duncan died 10 days after he entered the facility. He came to Dallas on September 20th from his native Liberia, the epicenter of the West Africa Ebola outbreak. The chief of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, Dr. Thomas Frieden, says he is deeply saddened by Duncan's death, calling him the face that people now will associate with Ebola. Frieden says there cannot be a zero risk for Ebola in the United States as long as the outbreak continues in West Africa. Meanwhile, President Barack Obama says fighting Ebola is a national security priority. He said new screening measures for travelers coming from Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone will be put in place. That's it for this Thursday, October 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing every one of you in Africa a very good Thursday.
Do you love African music?
Music time in Africa.
Wake, 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 wake. Umaru, wake.
This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900, 2000, and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.
Hello, this is Sunday Shomari. Join me every Monday for your lighthearted show, Let's Talk. That's right, Monday at 17:30 UTC for interviews, great music, and a whole lot of laughter. Right here at the VOA Africa.